This is CliffCentral.com.
Yes.
Can you just say fabulous?
Fabulous.
Yes.
It's absolutely fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous. Simon Anoki, welcome to the show. It's Frankly Speaking, 1 hour of all the rubbish that has happened over the year.
WTF 2017.
Same as last year, huh?
Same as last year.
We should just do a pre-record.
Yeah. Like, in January, we do a pre-record for 2018.
Exactly. You know,
because it's always the same characters.
It is. Really is. And sub-characters of the same characters. You're 100% right. Hey, man. It is 1 year to look back at, and we're going to do it with the fabulous Chris Vick. He is in studio today. He's left his children behind, finally, and he is in studio, so we'll talk to him a little bit later. Also, Rory, I suppose we've got to say it at some stage, you know.
Do you mean a little bit later? What am I supposed to do in the meantime? Look at you guys.
Listen, I have broadcaster privilege right now. You chill. All right, you just chill there. You drink your water.
I mean, you start 4 minutes late, and then you kind of bounce me into 9:30 or something like that.
I don't know why his mic is even on.
I know. It's not your time, Chris. It's not your time. Anyway, he's ready to go. Rory, this is our second last show.
Yeah, in the slot, in this format.
Chris, and, stop being a dick. Okay.
And we decided to invite our most loyal listener / guest.
He's our most loyal listener. We've got serious problems. I'll tell you
well,
that for sure.
There you go. We're reaching the end of an era.
An illustrious career. Let's be honest.
Career. So how many years, Andrew? Is it 3 years?
Three. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
3 years.
3 years. Doing this. It's sad. But next week we'll get into it on our last show. But today,
sad. What are you guys gonna cry?
Well, over? Well, you're happy because he does bet for the other team, right? On the other side are competitors.
The Renegade Report.
No, this guy.
Don't have competitors.
So he's just happy. He's just happy now. We're off air. There's no competition for him anymore.
It's true.
So yeah. But
you're talking about 702, where I'll be on between Christmas and mid January. Is that what you were talking about?
Can you switch his mic
between 9 and 12?
Can you switch his mic off, please?
No, I don't want to. He's sinking himself. I mean, who the hell is on during the Christmas period, 9 to 12? Who's listening anyway?
I'm playing festive music.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Wall to wall Trumpies in them, nothing else.
The Trumpies Christmas album. I look forward to hearing that one.
Fort Lewis is the best track.
So we're speaking about WTF 2017.
Why don't you say what the fuck? I mean, you're allowed to swear.
Yeah, yeah, you can say it.
So why the WTF thing?
No, it's a hashtag acronym for Twitter. You know, we try to keep
hashtag the acronym.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's not right. It's just,
that's an abbreviation.
As you can see, the show has already gone pear-shaped, and we are now 6 minutes into it. Welcome to it. If you've just joined us, we're doing What the Fuck 2017 with Chris Vick, our favorite guest in studio. We say that to all our guests, by the way, Chris. And if you want to tell us your what the fuck moments, you can WhatsApp on 0797482090, or you can tweet us at Rory Shabalala or at Yebo_Levy, and we'll take some of those moments as well.
Mine is Chris Vick 3, by the way.
Chris Vick 3, 2
get a better
and 1.
Chance of retweeting if you tag me.
It's because you have no one else to retweet. Chris, thank you for joining us. Before we get to you, Rory.
Yes, my friend.
How has 2017 been for you?
Oh, hard, man. The 2017 has been really, really tough. And it's specifically been tough around the things you can't control, at least the things I can't control. You know, so I think it's always manageable if it's the stuff within your control. But it just seems like everything outside of your control, outside of my control, is just like being super tough. But stretching, one has to believe that it's preparation for bigger and better. So yeah, my 2017 has been, but I've also been on this journey, and you know it, of not getting distracted. So I've also been a lot calmer through 2017.
How's that working for you?
Every now and then, like, people that go out with the old flag dressed in black, they trigger me, and I lose sight of my focus. But this year has been all about it. It's just like, hey, not getting distracted. learning a lot around, you know, like Nigerians and so on were saying, like, why are you South Africans so sensitive? Or why are you South Africans just get so distracted? Every little thing you have to, like, discuss it and debate it and so on. Just like, focus on what's more important. So it's been, I think, a year of trying to figure out what is most important and trying not to get distracted from it.
Chris, personally, your year? Before we get into the world,
having children, yeah, most phenomenal thing.
I mean, at 75, but I talk about that's quite a feat. Eh?
Yeah, it is. But I mean, science is amazing. You know? The girls were born at the age of 5, so that's how it works out. But it's been great. Been great. It's given me a different perspective, you know, and grounded me. And I just love them.
Help me understand the different perspective.
Well, I think, you know, when you do the kind of work I do, which is sort of flying close to the edge without a parachute, you don't often think about consequences, and you don't think about, I mean, I used to live life day by day. And so in terms of politics and the kind of circles that I move in, I would think about the future, but I wouldn't be too concerned. I'd always think about tomorrow, not about 10 years' time. And I think having the twins has just made me see things completely differently. It sort of personalizes it. It personalizes the political. And I've always been very passionate about what I do, but now I'm even more passionate about trying to make a different kind of difference. That's what matters to me.
Wow, man. Nothing but kids can drive a person towards that kind of reflection. Andrew, any kids this year for you?
Geez, thankfully not. No kids that I know of. So that's
you have to have sex to have children, right?
This guy's ungovernable.
Just because he figured it out and he eventually had kids, now he looks down on
now he's putting
now
it
he looks
on
down
me,
on now all
now
of us.
Now he's putting it on me. The secret recipe, this guy. Oh my goodness.
How's your year been, bro?
Yeah, man, I think it's been difficult. It's been a difficult 2017. Lots of personal challenges. And then of course lots of societal challenges, and they kind of breed into one. So yeah, lots of learnings, hey? I think as you grow up and you get older, you start to really learn shit faster. So that's, I think, what I'm getting down to. But yeah, I think let's get into what we think this year has been. Chris, Rory, one of the biggest headlines for me, you know, besides the ANC and all the bullshit, and we'll get into that, and Zuma and Gupta's and whatever, but one of the saddest moments was Essie Dumeni, for me at least. I don't know how you guys feel. Maybe that's a starting point. Chris, your thoughts on Essie Dumeni and what's been going on there?
For me, it's kind of vindicates the cynicism we've had about the way government treats people. You know, we do talk about state capture and people looting millions, but when you drill into life of Essie Dumeni, it's a bankrupt provincial department, politically mismanaged. Takes a decision which is still very, very hard to explain that results in the most vulnerable people in society being dumped in houses that just aren't equipped to deal with them. A friend of mine is one of the people who lost a sister through that whole saga. And I had to interact... sorry, that Cohiba had... remnants. I had to interact with her around preparing a statement to the hearings, and it's astounding, because I mean, we talk about 140 people. That's the number of people in a small airline plane. Right? Mm. It's a huge number of people.
Yeah.
And in her case, I mean, her sister was mentally ill, was taken to a proper clinic, was treated, and then this decision was made to cut costs because the health department was short of money. So she got dumped in a house in a Pretoria township, along with between eight and ten other people. It's not clear.
Mm.
No medical care, no food, no water, no toilets. I mean, you basically just rock up at someone's house and say, "Here are eight people. They're
we'll
yours.
We'll give you a cut.
We'll give you a cut." Yeah. So she wasn't consulted on where her sister went. When her sister died, she found out when they phoned and said, "Can you come and fetch the body?" Imagine that, right? Yeah. Imagine that day. Yeah. Then she went to the supposed place of shelter, and they said, "Oh no, the body's at a mortuary." They sent her to the wrong mortuary. She eventually found her sister in another mortuary. The people running the mortuary say, "Hey, by the way, while you're here, can you help us trace the relatives of the seven other bodies that we have from that same place.
Trauma on top of trauma.
8 from 8, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's so. And then she said, "But I want a post-mortem." And the response was, "No, you can't instruct a post-mortem. The government has to instruct a post-mortem." So it just kept going on and on and on. And I mean, then, you know, I think about 2 or 3 years have passed since that happened. You then go through the hearings themselves, where Edani Matlangu is missing in action. We still don't know where she's doing a degree.
If she's doing a degree.
Completely irresponsible. No sense of accountability from her. You get the officials coming in who talk as if they were dealing with reams of paper rather than with people. You know, we move this one here, we move this one there. It just sort of encapsulates, along with Michael Komape, the young boy who died in Polokwane, also taken up by Section 27. But it just encapsulates the cruelty of the current public service we have and the political leadership that we have. To take those decisions in the first place is one thing. But this complete lack of accountability and responsibility and a complete lack of action once a problem is exposed. And I think we're seeing the tip of many icebergs. Yeah. I think that this is happening across society, that the ANC in particular is just letting people down. Mm. And it's compounded by a public service that has good people in it, but it also has huge pockets of people who are much more interested in running their own businesses or taking a slice along the way. Mm. So that whole notion of public service to the public, is gone. The whole notion of servant leadership, if it ever existed, is gone. It's not about servant leadership. It's not about setting a tone that says, ultimately, we are here to make people's lives better. You know, so those two cases, I think, Life is a Dominion and Michael Komape, really, for me, symbolize what 2017 is about. And I don't know how much longer... people are going to put up with this shit.
But does not say something as well, just about, you know, we always used to think, or at least I used to think, that this was concentrated in specific areas, right? So where certain group of people are around those people's orbit, that's where all of the rot is. We always used to think, for example, that the Gauteng ANC were the ones who had it, who at least were the shining beacon in all of this. And then you look at it and you say, okay, so it's happening in Gauteng. There's still no accountability. And then you look at some of the people that have gone to testify, so Dr. Makgabo Manamela and so on, and even at that level. So it's not even at the political level. It's just, so across society, horizontally, but also just, it's not just at a political level. It just seems like the further down you go, there's just this lack of care, lack of empathy, lack of just shame even at doing some of these things. So what's going on, and is there still hope? I mean, you look at this, for me, signals just how hopeless the situation might be, actually. And maybe I'm just being pessimistic, just one of those mornings, but it's really, really sad. What does this signal for us as South Africans, and will the replacement of one candidate by another, one person by another, actually make a difference? Because this goes to the heart of who we are as a people, and it clearly looks like we're depraved.
I don't think that, sorry, I don't think there's a candidate who's a silver bullet who's going to turn this around. I mean, I think they all have huge issues, baggage problems, etc. But I think whoever gets the job, one of the biggest challenges they're going to face is to turn around the public service. Mm. Because the public service is the machine that has to deliver on these things, right? And I mean, I've done three stints. I've done my national service three times. Once in 94, where we were all fresh, energetic social justice activists working in the government. I went back in 2000, where there was a beginning of a sense of malaise because the politics was polluting the way the public service operated. And then I was back again in 2009. In the Human Settlements Ministry, where we found 60% of the staff who worked there were running their own businesses on the side. And some of those were running businesses which were in complete conflict with what they were doing. And we had a very senior guy running a B&B from his home. And every time there was a conference that people from out of town, they stayed in his B&B. Wow. You know? So, and this is a very senior person, like number three in the department. Hmm. And I think that's what's happened. It's 23 years after democracy. You have a public service which, as I say, has pockets of excellence and people are trying very hard. But they learn the culture of the political leadership and the administrative leadership who are there, which is, I don't care.
Yeah.
It's become a very selfish, I think we've become a very selfish nation, very self-interested. And I think that the political leadership has defined that, and the administrative leadership has copied that, and corporate South Africa has copied it as well. I'm not as depressed as you. I mean, I think that I take a long-term view. I'm not December, to me, doesn't really matter to a large extent who comes in. It's what gets done with who is in charge. If Ramaphosa comes in and he doesn't start locking people up and he doesn't get rid of corrupt ministers and he doesn't pay attention to the economy, you might as well have Nkosi Sazana Dlamini Zuma.
Yeah, it's not going to make a difference.
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge, right? It applies to people like you and I as well. You know, I can sit back and say, public service is fucked, it's corrupt, etc. But if conditions change, I would go back. I would want to make a difference because I realize we can't abdicate responsibility to other people now. Things are so bad in the economy, in the public service, in society, that we have to get involved and not just be critical of people who are doing it, but find ways in which we can make a difference.
Well, that leads us to almost another big point, is that in the midst of all of this, and perhaps just a point of hope, is that we had a lot of civil activism, you know, a lot of people that have never marched before, that have never gotten involved, getting off their bums and going out and showing their discontent. So on the one side, while government and leadership has disappointed, it seems like we're slowly beginning to see the citizen rise. And Andrew, you were at the heart of this, taking photos right in the middle of it. You at some stage got shot by rubber bullet.
Thankfully, not this year. Last year was a great year for shootings. I think the question really is what is that activism looking like at the moment? So we all went and we marched in some way or form, took a Wednesday or a Friday off, wore a shirt and went to the union buildings. But past that, what did we do? You know, and I include myself in that. What does good civil service and civil activism look like? And we've spoken a little bit about civil service. Let's talk about civil activism. What could that look like? Chris, you've been involved in some civil activism movements across your career. how have you felt in terms of society? And is there actually a big change? Or is it more just like, you know, we talked about the slacktivism, Twitter activists. Now it's moving towards maybe, you know, people are actually walking now, so they're getting their 10,000 discovery points when they put their Fitbit on or something. But has that actually changed the game, you know? And Chris, from your thought process,
I think civil society has been more coherent this year than in the past. I mean, you've seen coalitions forming. You don't see the problems that exist within the coalitions, but I think that there's definitely been a stronger public presence from civil society. But I mean, my experience was there's a very real sense of fatigue now, which works in favor of the people who are fucking with society.
Yeah.
If you think of the Gupta emails, for example, 200,000 emails get released to a group of journalists, and week after week after week after week, we have these revelations, right? And I think we just become exhausted. And I don't think the response is, let's get back on the streets, let's have Tahrir Square, let's do what people in South Korea did. The other thing which a friend of mine pointed out is the geography of apartheid makes it very difficult to organize mass, right? I mean, to try and combine, if we were to organize a demo in Alex, for example, and expect people from Soweto and Sandton and other areas to go, it's really, really difficult to do that. So
it can't be national. It can only be sort of regional.
You'll have the pockets, But I do think that sense of fatigue is really going to be, it's got to give. You know, and I think, for example, in the sectors I move in, if NDZ is elected in December, people are going to be out on the streets early next year. In a sense, it's a new struggle, right? Because you've got a replication of Jacob Zuma in the form of NDZ. So you might see that. But you might also see people think, well, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
And it carries on. And I mean, when you've got elements of a failed state already, which I think Life as Idemeni symbolizes, and the Michael Komape case, and the countless others that we've seen. You've seen SOCs, state-owned companies, getting looted to the tune of 700 billion rand. You have complete palookas running those institutions and getting away with it. it's got to give at some point. Mm. The question is, I don't think there's going to be a kind of historical tipping point.
Yes.
I think it's just going to come out of the blue. It might be another Marikana. It might be something that is that brutal that really triggers the response that we need.
You know, I want to talk or attach on to what you're saying and speak a little bit about the media's role. But before we hit there, potentially one of the turning points that I thought would change the game is social grants. Now, we remember the palaver that happened with Sasa and the fact that they were potentially literally days away from not paying 17 million people social grant money. I mean, that could have been it, Chris. That could have been the moment where in 2017 we saw the biggest corruption scandal with what were they called? One something.
It's Net One.
Net One, yeah. And a moment where, you know, a lot of people who rely on the grants wouldn't have got them, and that could have been it.
But it might still happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you should rule out in April a complete fracas around this kind of thing, because we don't know if the post office can carry it out, etc. But I think the other thing to worry about is whether the state can afford to pay social grants the way it does now. I mean, there's talk of a social welfare bubble where you reach a situation where the fiscus just can't tolerate the demands.
Especially when revenue is in decline, exactly. Right? They're not collecting as much as they used to. Yeah. So now, yeah. And we're looking at free education, but I digress.
No, I mean, I think it's what's interesting is you can't move around money that you don't have, right? So there are haircuts taking place in every government department to try and fund the president's daughter's ex-boyfriend's cigarette box proposal. but the social welfare bubble is a very real issue, because even if you have to cut it by 20 rand or 40 rand, I mean, that's survival money for people. There's a misnomer that people use their social grants to get a weave or buy cell phone units. It's not true. I mean, that's survival money. And the minute you take that away or you cut it, you are pissing off the poorest of the poor in a very direct way. And I think for the ANC, the dilemma there is it's not just that they are trying to provide a social welfare net, but there's often a sense of dependency where people think, if I'm not an ANC member, I won't get my social grant. There's a relationship between them. So you're pissing off 15 million potential voters as well a year before an election.
But
it's a very difficult situation.
Is that not the issue? Is that the risk is not actually those voters? It's how the ANC then is going to begin to respond to them. Because, like you said, it's very difficult to organize. It's very difficult to actually do anything. So, you know, to that mass, we speak about it as a huge mass, but it's a highly fragmented mass geographically. But when that begins to become an issue, how does the ANC and government begin to respond, begins to push us towards a tipping point where people get killed and we have another Marikana, or we have a situation where they get to call a state of emergency. And that's been bandied about as a scenario where Zuma gets to suspend the constitution and do whatever he wants. So is that the biggest thing that we should be worried about?
Well, I think there's a lot more, but it's certainly in the top five issues to look out for. Because if there's strain in the national fiscus, which there isn't, it's going to get worse. I mean, that's the other weird aside. We now have junk status, right? On an ordinary day in South Africa, there would be outrage about that, and there would be a response to it. But I do think it's one of the top issues, particularly because there's so much suspicion of corruption. And you can't, I don't think Batabile Dlamini, for all her intents and purposes, enjoys public confidence. It's not like we're saying, no, it's okay, Batabile's in charge, it's going to get sorted out.
Yeah.
So it is. I mean, if I was thinking of investing in South Africa, if I was a foreigner, I'd be really worried about that potential of a real, not revolution, but I mean, every village and town, people not getting the money they used to or not getting money at all because of these problematic tenders that they get involved in. People are going to be really angry.
We're talking with Chris Vick, What the Fuck 2017. It is our end of year review of the year that we've just had. Very interesting conversation. Chris, we've been speaking a little bit about civil service, about civil activism. Of course, what came into the spotlight was, I suppose, the corporates, who weren't really in the spotlight until this year, really. You know, we always were thinking the Guptas and Zumas, it's all government tenders and it's all, you know, government issues and all the government and blah, 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 and they're siphoning money and blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly the spray of, and I suppose it did come from those 200,000 Gupta leaks, but of just corporate involvement in all these deals.
KPMG, SAP,
McKinsey.
Let's not forget Bell Pottinger.
Yeah. I mean, and these are the ones we know, right?
Yeah.
Like, there. I mean, I'm just waiting for two other big industries to get involved. The banking system. I mean, someone had to have done a deal somewhere along the line. It has to have happened. As well as the law, you know, and the legal firms.
But I think the banks are already sucked in. I mean, if you look at what's come out about HSBC, for example, thanks to Peter Hain in the UK, the banks some of the banks had a very definite role to play in this kind of thing. So they're already getting sucked into it. I mean, it's really interesting because I'm sure that what McKinsey got up to and what KPMG got up to and what SAP got up to, those are not unique cases.
No, not at all.
The difficulty is in this environment, right, where you have a political leadership that is bent beyond belief, bent like a paperclip, and you have people running SOCs who follow the lead. I think when corporates interact with those people who are following the lead, it's like, let's just make hay while the sun shines.
Well,
right?
Everyone's doing it. Yeah. So even the conscience doesn't kick in. It's simply that's the way we do business.
How we have to do business.
If you listen
right?
to if you go to sort of courses on doing business in Africa, it's always this thing about, hey, you know, don't bring your principles over here. You know, this is how things are done, and we do it until actually you get caught, and then we're like, wait a minute, you strayed far from the values line.
But even when you get caught, I mean, KPMG chopped 9 people, right? 2 weeks later, some of them were still at work. I'm sure they all got golden handshakes.
They got huge bonuses, yeah.
I mean, because they work in industries where white guys in suits look out for each other generally. I mean, that's the sort of the tendency that you're dealing with is it's a protectionist environment.
Wasn't it odd then that KPMG brought in a black female to fix this mess? You would have thought that they would have probably tried to get a white guy to come and fix it because they know that they'll get their friends to look out for them and make sure that the money continues to flow. And there was a big thing, and again, it speaks about these different views in South Africa where some people were like, well done, black woman, this is progress, we're moving forward, not under the best circumstances, but hey. But on the other hand, they were like, you know, you've just basically been given
a lead ship.
Yeah. You've been given a lead ship to try and sail, and you've taken it. Yeah. Well done.
I thought for a day.
Google it.
I don't know.
You've been given a lead ship to try and sail, and that was stupid. And you're basically going to drive us backwards, not forward.
But I don't know the person, right? But I suspect it's a token appointment. I don't think you take your head of HR and make them CEO, and think that they are going to turn the business around. Mm. So there are probably rooms full of white monopoly capital people in suits living at the Hyatt or somewhere like that, who are trying to do the real fixing. I don't think it was a sincere appointment at all. I think it was unfair on her. But again, that's how some sectors of corporate South Africa work. I think the McKinsey one is interesting, right? I mean, KPMG with the SARS report went way beyond what you would expect. But the McKinsey one, where they kind of went in and saw what Eskom is, which, if you look at what's been coming out of Parliament in the last week, it is a corruption clusterfuck. It's the only way to describe it. It is the most messed up state-owned entity that we have. So you're McKinsey, you're smart people, you know how to make money. So you go in and you make a proposition with a success fee before work is even done. I mean, it's like they just sort of arrived and thought, these dumb duckies don't know what they're doing. Let's just make hay while the sun shines. And they did it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I people in other consulting companies in Joburg say they push the boundaries, but the McKinsey guys really kind of went to the extreme. But again, it's because they see a president who pisses on the Constitution, builds himself a huge house and gets a dodgy loan to pay some of the money off. Doesn't get charged for 783 counts of corruption. And you just knock it on down the line,
laughs at the face of accountability.
And appoints the state security minister, Minister Bongo, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's been in office for a week. There's stories about a BMW. Another week later, a dodgy thing he did with land deals in Mpumalanga.
Mm.
Then he's offering to bribe people who are running commissions of inquiry against Eskom. I mean, again, on a normal day,
this would have been freaking
phenomenal. Phenomenal, particularly that he's your state security minister. I mean, no one should do it. But to have those three strikes against you within your first month in office is horrendous. And yet there he is, 2 weeks before the ANC conference. No one has said a word, no reprimand, no concern, no action at all. Mm. And that lack of culpability and the recognition that you can do wrong and you can just walk away. You can be made an ambassador to some foreign country, or if you're Kaidani Matlangu, you can go and study at a business school in the UK. It's that culture of a lack of accountability which I think is really going to be the ANC's downfall, because it shows the lack of passion and commitment to the people. And when caught out, turn our backs and walk away. You can't sustain governing or ruling party like that forever. It has to turn against you.
Just joined us. Welcome to the show. It's What the Fuck 2017. It is very hard to follow because we're moving at a rapid rate through a lot of things.
Slow.
Well, let's pick it up a notch. So we spoke about accountability of ministers and maybe the unaccountability of a minister, Pravin Gordhan, who also had his name in the headlines this year, getting fired and removed. I mean, that was a... I suppose it was always coming, right? It was always going to come. You know, like the Van Rooyen mistake and whatever. They needed a quick fix. They put in Pravin. But Pravin's like just a straight down the line arrow. I mean, you speak to the guy and like, I've never seen anything in my life. You know, like he flies economy class whenever he does it. You know what I mean? Like, so he was obviously going to butt heads at some stage. Let's not talk about his economic policies because that's another issue for discussion another day. But I mean, were you surprised that he got himself into this kind of a mess?
No, because I think he is very principled. And I think if you work in an unprincipled environment, you've got two options. You can carry on butting heads, which is the strategy he adopted, and speaking out. Or there's the Derek Hanekom option, which I think is as principled and probably more uncomfortable. It's probably more comfortable to be fired than to stay and feel the level of discomfort that you feel. But I think it's kind of symptomatic of the fact that the ANC is not one organization. There are still good people there in the leadership who are prepared to stand their ground. Pravin did it, suffered the price. Derek Hanekom and others haven't paid that price of losing their jobs. But it must be difficult. It must be very humiliating because everywhere you go, people are asking, how do you work with these guys?
There's like this big thing that's happening at the moment. A lot of rumors around about this big fracture in the ANC. Of course, ANC isn't one voice, but there seems to be a very, very clear line of two big movements happening within the ANC. And of course, there's probably more. But do you think that that'll actually break away at some stage? Do you think if the result goes to NDZ in December, that Pravin and Derek and friends and some people who are outside the party already will actually go, you know what, enough, and break out and contest in the 2019 election as a separate unified party?
I think if it did happen, I don't think the objective of a breakaway from the ANC would be to beat the ANC. I think the objective would be to destroy its majority. Because if there was a breakaway party, and I'm not talking about Makosi Koza's Ahang 2, right?
I'd love to hear more about your thoughts.
No, that's just silly. I mean, you don't pull together two civic organizations in the Free State, Northwest, and some remnants from the NFP. Do you remember the NFP?
Yes, in KZN.
Exactly. I mean, and call that a political party. Mm. A year and a half before an election.
Yeah.
I mean, you really got to build up to that. But if you think about it, the more crowded the space is outside the ANC, the better the chance that you can take away the ANC's majority. So if there was a thought among Pravin Gordhan and Derek Hanekom and others to split and form a political party, it would be to get 5% maximum, I would imagine. Yeah. So that the EFF chipping away, the DA is chipping away. Holomisa, I think, and the UDM finally have some growth potential. I don't know.
They've waited it out long enough.
Yeah, they have.
Let's just give them a few votes, guys. Come on, let's just get them. Thanks for coming, guys.
But I mean, Holomisa is working really hard to unite the opposition. He keeps trying to call a national convention. He's trying to get people together. The problem is those big heads in the DA and the white supremacists and the white privilege that says, nah, we're the biggest
effort,
right?
We can do it ourselves. Yeah.
And if there's a feasibility of a non-ANC coalition, and you've got historically ANC people in it. And let's not forget the South African Communist Party, right? Mm. Probably one of the last in the world, but it has about 250,000 members at the moment. It's significant. Mm. It's contesting against the ANC in Metsimoholo, Sasselburg, my own old hometown, right? Mm. They're fighting it out with the ANC and the EFF. And what that does, again, is it eats away at the ANC support majority, base. Yeah. So if you project that on a national level, where you've got the SACP contesting the ANC, and you've got possibly another party, you could bring the ANC majority down to below 50%.
Do you think it's for the purpose of a reverse takeover? So I mean, it's been interesting
to
watch.
You did go to business school, right?
I was about to say, what?
You just lost Andrew completely. Yeah. That's when you crash your car and it goes on top of another one. Going backwards.
Yeah, that's when you just switch off your mic and just relax, you know, you take a holiday.
But
what is a reverse takeover?
It's like they leave in order to, you know, pull the majority, force the ANC to come back and say, all right, guys, we need you. Almost what was thought was Julius's strategy at some stage is I'm going to bring you to the negotiation table, and then I'm going to come back on my terms, and we're going to basically take over.
I see.
Is that, do you think that there are prospects of that type? I mean, you've been listening. I don't know if you've, even at the Daily Maverick event, Julius has toned, like, it's different guy to when he started out, very conciliatory as well. So what is that all about? Do you think that is what 2019 is going to be about? Let's reduce the ANC and then let's make them bring us in on our terms.
I think that's a strong possibility, but I think the list of demands would be longer than the Freedom Charter, because there is so much that has to be done. There's so many commitments that you would need from the ANC before you go back. But the flip side of that is that the EFF and the UDM have learned the hard way that coalitions with the DA don't work either, right? Mm. I mean, Nelson Mandela Bay, Joburg, it's a shitstorm. I mean, those things are very hard to manage because it's all about egos. Yeah. The same with trying to form a left coalition or an anti-ANC coalition. The egos that you have in those rooms are massive.
Politicians.
Right? It'll be about who sits where, whose name comes first, who gets to make the longest speech, which is going to make it very difficult to knit together something. So the option of recapturing the ANC is a possibility. But I think a better option is to just let it die. You know, I mean, I think it's a damaged brand, and I think there's such a loss of. I mean, I've been a member since I was 25, and as this lighty points out, I'm 57 now, right? And it's very difficult.
The lighty being Andrew.
Yes, in the salmon shirt. It's. I mean, you go through this tremendous emotional difficulty. It's like a battered spouse. You know, you keep thinking he or she's going to stop beating me up, and then boom, Bongo gets caught doing what he does. Mm. Lynn Brown does what she does. So you go through this constant sort of battery of emotions, but you keep hoping that it's going to change. But I think people are starting to think, no, it's done. It can't self-correct. I mean, that's what the veterans talk about, the thing will self-correct. If it's got four flat tires, the chassis bent, and there's no roof on it, it can't self-correct. It's fucked, right?
But the thing is, Chris, you know, with that in mind, right, the self-correction, where do people like yourself and Pravin Gordhan take their vote to? Because, I mean, the DA, you're not going to go near, right? Because it has its own issues, its own problems, right? So we don't even have to talk about that. The EFF, one could argue that your vote could go there, but one has to question, are the powers, that the people at the top and the people in power there, are they corruptible in themselves, right? Have they shown a history of corruption? So are they trustworthy? You've got UDM, which would be a dark minority horse in, you know, so where do you take your vote?
For me, that's an issue I'll answer in 2019. I mean, I think it's much more important now to play a role in bringing about change in the society we live in. Mm. The vote is a one-off thing, and yes, it does define national and provincial leadership in 2019. But I think I would want to see how it plays itself out. But there's a particular issue I have now, separate to what we've been talking about,
right,
which is the age of the people who are trying to provide leadership. Right? I mean, on the same day that Ramaphosa's slate was published, and Ramaphosa's slate, I didn't know anybody on that list who's younger than me, right? Mm. It's toppies, old people.
Yeah.
who fall asleep at meetings and have a lot of baggage. Mm. I have huge respect for the intellect, but I don't know if there's the energy and the vision and the enthusiasm there to lead the country out of the shit
in that role. Yeah.
But on the same day, Mbuyiseni Ndlozi from the EFF posted a video of himself in his gumboots and red overalls in his office in Parliament, warming up with a gumboot dance to go and take on someone from some dodgy SOC. And on a purely emotional level, I thought, I'd rather invest in that kind of leadership, right? And remember, the EFF leadership have got time on their side. They're all in their mid-30s, right?
Yeah.
They can become president when they're 50 or 60, but that energy and the enthusiasm, which you also see in some of the other political parties, I think is really important. I think that people of my generation, we are really fucked by apartheid. And by the struggles that we fought.
Mm.
And I think that damage, in a way, prevents us from thinking about servant leadership. There is a sense of entitlement. I did my time.
Yeah.
You must respect that.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think we must move aside for people who've got the energy and enthusiasm and who have a stake in the future.
So you speak about the EFF leadership having time, but we also know that in politics... That would mean that, for example, that leadership needs to stay in place for the next 20 years in the EFF leading. And political animals are political animals. There's somebody who's waiting for somebody to move and so on. Do you think that they've got the staying power to make sure that they hold on?
Can they pull a
Buthelezi or what's UDM guy?
They might do that.
The only way that they then get to realize all of this potential.
Well, unless one of them becomes president by the age they're 40.
If
you look at Macron, you look at Barack Obama, there are very, very competent young presidents or former presidents out there.
I don't
think it's always inevitable that they stick around forever. I mean, I worked with someone who was a politician, then became a businessman, and then tried to become a politician again. I mean, people reinvent themselves in those roles, depending on what they want and how society shifts.
There's a few issues that 2017, as you start rolling it out, it becomes a very interesting year.
It's a dense year.
Dense year, yeah. I mean, you spoke about leadership and aged leadership. Well, we only have to go across our border to talk about that as well. I mean, probably one of the biggest moments in African history since the independence of a lot of states, since the democracy, Robert Mugabe getting cooed on. I mean, thoughts on that, Chris? Like, was that a big moment for you? Was that just coming?
I think it was a big moment, but there were much bigger moments at the time. You know, I mean, I think that there's so much going on with South Africa, and I'm fascinated by what happened in Zimbabwe because, you know, I think that Mugabe was a hero to my generation because of the way he led the liberation war. He gave the British a bloody nose. And in the beginning, after Zimbabwean independence, I think made a phenomenal difference in terms of land reform.
Education.
I mean, the Zimbabwean education system was probably the best in Africa. And I think their land reform program, initially the land reform program was excellent. But it's that notion of power corrupting and what happens to radical leadership once you're in power for a long time. I mean, that's why it's interesting to look across the continent that the really good leaders, Sankara, etc., they get bumped off before that kind of thing happens. So we're left with a memory and a legacy of these amazing revolutionaries.
Yes, we don't get to see them in the
90s.
Yeah, exactly.
In the 90s. But I think that sort of big man politics that Mugabe represented is coming to an end in some parts of Africa. And I think that's encouraging. I read on social media this morning, there's one who's been president for 43 years, for example.
Mm.
That's very dangerous and damaging, right? Mm. But people are starting... So in South Africa, we also look at Mugabe. We make comparisons with Zuma, which are not entirely appropriate, but it doesn't matter.
Mm.
A lot of us know we're chatful with our president. He's overstayed his welcome. Mugabe did the same.
We don't want to see that happening here. So we're a lot more...
Oh, yeah. But here, I mean, I don't know which army would go in. Would it be Carl Niehaus and Kebi? would they borrow money for taxi fare or chow it from some...
Well, you only need four cars, you know. That's really what it is, you know. Let's bring it back into our borders because obviously, you know, you're right. There's been a lot that's been going on. I think that the The other interesting social movement that's happened this year is the Me Too campaign. And, you know, you were speaking about NMU earlier, which rang bells for our friend Danny Yordan. And fascinating how that Me Too campaign has now brought out the misogyny that lives within our society.
I think there's a really exciting dynamic developing around that. And I think that, in a sense, references to Kwesi's case have really sped up that conversation. And I think the hashtag MeToo initiative have done that too. But it's not stopping men acting like pigs. And exactly. I think that's the problem. Yeah. Whether you're a deputy minister or some doers who lost in a singing competition called Idols, right? That's the problem. I think that women increasingly are finding their voice and are driving these messages. But we've yet to find the way to stop men acting like pigs. And I think that's where the real work needs to be done. We need to look at what little boys are being taught when they're little, how they interact with each other as they get older, and what society thinks about men who abuse women. And there still isn't a national conversation or a national initiative around that. I think we're somewhere close to 16 days of activism. I don't know.
It started already.
There we go. Yeah. Such a fantastic campaign, right? I mean,
has it started?
It has.
That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
But even when it does, it doesn't make an impact. Yeah. Everybody seems to agree we need 365 days of activism against violence against women, but it doesn't happen. But I think, again, it's kind of symptomatic of where we are as a society. The way we drive, the way we interact, how rude we are to each other, the lack of respect for each other. You add to that the kind of macho culture and you guys who eat meat and have too many hormones popping around your body and drink beer and watch rugby and all these blood sports. we've got to, as men, I think we really got to think hard about what we do.
What's it going to take? Because, again, it almost brings us back to the beginning where you're speaking about your family, and the beginning of a family is outside of the family unit. There's very little that you... But who is it going to take, or what is it going to take to make these deep changes that need to be made at a societal level? I mean, I've been in places where I've asked people, so why do you you guys know that diabetes, the effects of diabetes, you're afraid of them and all of that, but you still don't even bother to take care of your health. There's knowing that male misogyny and so on is wrong, and then there's actually doing, and it just feels like the doing tends to be taken as it's too much effort. I'm already stuck in my ways. What is it going to take? Because we're speaking, hashtagging, it's not going to make a difference. It's just like racism. You don't see it changing. So what is it? What could it possibly take to change us?
I mean, it's there's a whole lot of issues that will make a difference. Not one of them will magically work, but you have to punish people who do it, right? And racists and men who abuse women too often get away scot-free, right?
Yeah.
So there's that one. There's also sort of setting the tone, setting leadership examples. I'm sorry, when you have a president like Zuma on trial who cannot even go to the launch of a 16 days of activism thing because it's just contradictory, right?
Yeah.
Manana is the same kind of thing. I mean, look how long the Manana case dragged out before he fessed up, right? I mean, I had people approaching me saying, can you help this guy? Can you do some PR work for him? My response, and it's the same with anyone who does that kind of shit, go into counseling, sort your head out, right? So there's got to be that kind of, in a sense, accountability around behavior. But we have to really start looking at what children are learning. And I'm not just saying this because of the twins, right? When I see an 18-year-old white kid pull out a gun in a squatter camp. Remember that case in I think it was in Northwest a couple of years ago, where he drove past an informal settlement and just started shooting at people. Now, those kids don't... That's not from playing TV games, right?
Yeah.
Your parents taught you
that
shit, right?
Like,
so what are parents teaching their children? What are they learning at school? What role models do they have? I smoke occasionally, as you know. I have a small cigar. And you can tell me that it kills me.
Yeah.
I'm still going to do it, right?
Yeah.
It's the same with drinking. It's the same with people who drive too fast or don't wear their seatbelts. We know that it's wrong, but until diabetes kills you, it's a theory.
Not, right? Even while diabetes is killing you.
Yeah.
It seems like we have these deep issues that we have to deal with, and it's going to take... It can't be done by a single person, and perhaps as we think about December ANC, it's not going to take an individual to change what needs to happen. We need a mass movement. But again, what is it going to take, and who is it going to take to drive us towards that mass movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sexism and debate and campaigns are very interesting because as males and as men, we can easily say, no, we are pro, you know, we're feminists, we're this, we're that and the other. But of course, feminism and gender equality is such a nuanced thing, right? It's such a spectrum of things. So you can say you're good in this sector, but then the way you treat women in this sector is completely different, you know, or the way you expect your wife or your girlfriend to make food for you, that, you know, it's so nuanced on so many levels.
That's the problem, right? It's actually the extremes are one end, but it's actually the guys that live in this gray area that perpetuates.
And I'm included in that, right? Yeah. I'm totally included in that. That's the problem. It's very easy for me to be like, oh, me too, whatever, and you know, I support women and women must speak up, but I've also got some serious shit to deal with as a male and as an individual who is a man in the society to go, actually, I need to stop seeing women like this and I need to start seeing them like this. And that means I have to act like that in every single situation. And it's difficult, man. It's very difficult.
But also the point you make about nuance. I mean, I think we're living in a society that's increasingly less nuanced. Right?
Yeah.
You now have to condense your thoughts into it was 140, it's now 280 characters. We don't read or understand issues, we read and understand headlines.
Yes.
Donald Trump kind of is making a major contribution to the dumbing down that's going on, the death of ideology. You know, so that sort of combination makes it very difficult to have nuanced conversations about feminism or sexism or any other form of discrimination. That's the difficulty. Mm. Even if I look at, and it's a weird sort of tangent, but if you look at Bell Potzinger, KPMG, and McKinsey, once they were found out, once they were bust, there was no way they were going to explain their way out of that situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was such a two-dimensional conversation. Mm. And I think that's the way that we tend to have those conversations nowadays, is this black or white. There's no nuance mm-hmm. in between. And to try and have a conversation about texture, which some people tried to do during the Me Too campaign, and then you get Danny Jordan's response, which tells you very clearly there is no real
conversation. Yeah.
It's a real fuck you attitude. Mm. And it makes it hard to kind of push back, push the boundaries on these kind of conversations.
I'm interested, Chris, we've mentioned it a few times, and Rory, you know, before we get into the end of our hour here, and I want to see if there are any positives that came out of 2017 as well, but the media and the role of the media, you spoke about headlines. I mean, the media... there's the white monopoly capital media issue that runs in South Africa and runs deep in South Africa, but there's also just general media in a capitalistic society. You need to put the most extreme headline down. With these Gupta emails and these Gupta leaks, you know, as great as it is, and it's a lot of work and a lot of reporting, geez, I don't know if they've done it well, hey? I really don't, because of that thing. It's so saturated. I don't want to read it anymore. I'm over it. I'm over the nuances within those 250,000 emails because of the way and the structure in which we've actually dealt it as a media.
What's the alternative?
I don't know. I mean, this is an interesting conversation to have. I don't know.
I think it could have been packaged much better, particularly from a treatment point of view.
Yeah.
I have fights with people at ENCA and City Press about it. I don't want to say someone like Sky TV or CNN is flawless, but when there is a crisis, yes. they say there's a yes, crisis, yes. right? And they bundle
it
all together.
And they treat it like a crisis.
And they let you know that there's something serious. And generally, there's a consequence 2 or 3 days after that. I think in some cases, media outlets have contributed to our sense of fatigue because you hoy in a state capture story and the next minute there's something else. There's a packaging and a treatment problem that I think hasn't maximized the impacts of what is in those documents. But I feel for them. I mean, imagine
it's hard.
You get 200,000 emails to go through and you have to join the dots. And a lot of them are just little one-liners, the ones I've seen. There's no kind of coherent thread.
Yeah.
It's a massive investigative journalism job. But if you look at the Panama Papers, you look at the other one.
Yes, the Panama Papers is a great example.
The way that was treated and packaged and the impact that it had. I mean, the way people were outed very quickly with lots of evidence behind it. So let's hope the people who did it have learned the lessons, because I'm sure there are more Gupta emails out there.
They're coming out.
We know they're on Zoom emails because he doesn't even know how to switch on his iPad. But there must be a lot of other evidence in there that can be very useful to society.
Yeah. Andrew, so you, as we wrap up, I guess the big thing is we've spoken about all of these negative things. And I started out saying I am... I'm not feeling very optimistic at the end of 2017, but is there anything that we can look back at and say, you know what, I'm really happy about that, right? And don't tell me sport. Don't tell me so-and-so won this, that. Just something.
Chiefs and Pirates. Have you seen the PSL results?
Yeah, you can't speak about the Springboks.
The leaders are like...
You can't speak about Bafana Bafana.
Seven draws, two losses, and one win, and they're at the top of the PSL, for heaven's
sake. Can only speak about Wade van Niekerk, but let's not talk about that. What else can we look at and say... you know, this gives me hope, or this was a high point for me for 2017, Chris.
I mean, you know, in radio we like to take things full circle as pros, right? Mm. I start at the beginning. Life is Idumeni and the Michael Komape case, depressing, horrific as they are indications of two things. One, that there is eventually accountability, and that accountability might start to have an impact on how the state reacts to its citizens and how it treats its citizens. I take hope from that. Mm. Secondly, the fact that it's been led by civil society. Mm. Section 27 people are social justice soldiers. They are amazing, right? Yes. But we must look at that and say, okay, so it can be done. It'll help us get rid of that sense of hopelessness and empower people to take on dodgy people, whether they're state or business or private individuals, more and more often. So I take hope out of that. Yeah. As I say, sad, tragic, but if it spreads and you have greater accountability within government and you have a stronger sense of civil activism within society, we can make sure that 2017 is the worst fucking year we've had, and 2018 is going to be the beginning of a different kind of engagement.
I think for me, the two big moments was the inquiries. So the SABC inquiry and this ESCOM inquiry have been brilliant. I mean, if you ever wanted to reinvigorate your hope into a parliamentary inquiry, that was the moment, right? Some of the things that came out of there were... but I mean, it was like watching Generations 1 again. You know, it was just so fantastic every day. And the second one, I think, is the marches, and specifically the EFF march. I couldn't believe how crazy the energy was at that EFF march to union buildings on a random Wednesday. It was un-freaking believable. So there is power in the people, and I think we just got to keep remembering that.
I got nothing to add. I think if there's anything I can add is that in the US, if we can take a few things, it was Giving Day yesterday, and I think about civil society, and I think about, so after Thanksgiving they have Giving Day where they give money to, you know, basically go and give to civil society and so on. Is if civil society is fighting for us as vigorously as this, let's support them. Let's actually go out. Like, what civil society organization are we happy about, and how do I give into their cause?
Chris, man, thank you, brother. Thank you. We have appreciated your comments throughout the 3 years of doing this. And
shit, I've been here twice. You make it sound like I come here every week.
Bro, you WhatsApp me all the time. You say, you're shit. I love that.
That's,
you know,
not true, because I'm not listening.
He does not dare do that to me.
No, but I, all the best with your last show next week. I hope you don't cry. I hope someone tunes in, and I hope you enjoy life after that.
You're such a legend. I know that no one will be listening to 702 during December, but if there are people
between 9 and 12 from the 27th or 28th, it's on my Twitter account.
Jeepers, man. Chris Vick, always a pleasure. Thanks, mate. Rory, we'll see you again next week. Last show, my brother.
Yeah, Jovicho. One last time.
One last time, my brother.
Show fit.
Sharp.
This is CliffCentral.com.